We continue our deliberations with a discussion on rate regulation, and I give the floor to Mariela.
Thank you very much, Hans. Good morning. As you might have noted, today we have quite a lot of material to cover. And so let me first tell you how we have organized this presentation so that you have a better understanding of where am I during this introduction. We have split the presentation in four sessions. In the first session, I'll briefly mention the aspects of the model that we have gone through in the last meetings. In the second session, I'll then cover what we are planning to discuss today and what we are going to be discussing in June. In the third session of this presentation, I'll highlight what is our recommendation. And in the fourth session, then, I'll give you the underlying reasons for our recommendations. So starting then with the first session of this presentation, what we have been discussing so far. Well, this is summarized in Agenda Paper 9A. This paper is for information only, and it provides a summary of tentative decisions today, highlighting that the model uses a supplementary approach to recognize the incremental rights and obligations that arise from timing differences. Timing differences are created when the entity carries out an activity to fulfill its service requirements in an earlier period or at a later period than the period in which the entity can charge customers for the activity through the rate. And those incremental rights and obligations, we also discussed that they do meet the asset and liability definitions in the conceptual framework, and that they form the unit of account that we will be using in this model. And we have also discussed the scope of the model and the recognition criteria in March. So, second session of this presentation, what are we going to be discussing today and next month? So, the goal today is to discuss measurement. And we are planning to cover this in two meetings. You could have take a look to slide 47 in Agenda Paper 9B. And if you go to this slide, you will see an overview of the topics within measurement that we are planning to discuss today in May, and the topics that we are planning to discuss in June. And we are using this split to ensure that we can go through the main features of the measurement technique that we are recommending for regulatory assets today, and we can go through areas that might involve more judgment in June. So to help focus our attention on the main features and the mechanics of the measurement technique that we are recommending, we have used some relatively straightforward examples. And in those examples, we have established the following assumptions. The estimates of future cash flows resulting from the regulatory assets do not need to be updated to reflect any variability. In slide 47, you'll see that in June, we're going to be discussing how to estimate the cash flows resulting from the regulatory assets and how would be the accounting for changes in those estimates. So we will complicate things a bit further. In the examples that you have in the slides in May, the existence or not of a significant financing component is a given assumption. We're going to relax this in June, and we're going to be discussing how to identify whether there is a significant financing component. And you might have also seen in the examples that the interest rate or the rate of return established in the regulatory agreement are considered to be the appropriate rates to use when discounting the estimates of future cash flows. And again, in June, we'll be discussing how to identify the appropriate discount rate and how to account for changes in the discount rate. Another point worth mentioning up front is that today's discussions will be focused on the measurement of regulatory assets. Having said that, we don't think that the analysis or the recommendations that we have prepared in the slides today would differ in the case of the measurement of regulatory liabilities, but we will confirm with you this point in June as well. So, third session then of this presentation, what we are recommending. This is summarized in slide 41 of this deck. And you might have seen that to get to our recommendation, we started our analysis considering the guidance on measurement in the conceptual framework, particularly the guidance about considering the characteristics of the asset, how the asset contributes to future cash flows. We've also considered what we have heard from users who are interested in information about the amount and the timing of those cash flows. So what we are recommending in slide 41 is that the measurement technique for regulatory assets reflects estimates of future cash flows that the regulatory assets will generate, which will include the cost of the assets used and operating expenses incurred, any margins on the operating expenses incurred in providing goods or services, and any interest on the operating expenses incurred or returns on the cost of assets used in providing goods or services. We are also recommending that the measurement technique discount those estimates of future cash flows if there is significant financing component. And we recommend that the measurement technique requires entities to update estimates of future cash flows if changes occur, and require entities to keep the discount rate established at initial recognition and change. So this is what we are recommending. And starting then with the fourth session of this introduction, I'll provide you the rationale for each of these four features of the measurement technique that we are recommending. So starting with bullet A, in the same slide 41, in the first box, what we considered in here when recommending that the measurement technique should reflect estimates of future cash flows that the regulatory assets will generate, including all of those components, we went back to the building block that the regulators use for setting the rate. And this is illustrated in slide 11 of the pack. And that slide shows the main components of the revenue that regulators typically allow entities to include in the rate. In this slide, we can see that regulators typically allow entities to recover the cost of assets by allowing them to include depreciation in the rate. Regulators typically allow entities also to recover operating expenses incurred in providing goods or services. And typically, operating expenses are recovered at 0% margin, but regulators might allow recovery of operating expenses at a specified margin. And regulators also typically allow entities to earn interest on operating expenses incurred or a return on the cost of assets used in providing goods or services. So we think that it's important to include all of these components in the measurement of the regulatory assets because those components directly affect the estimates of future cash flows generated from those assets. And because of these considerations, then, we recommend that the estimates of future cash flows reflect all of these components. Going to the second feature, which is to discount those estimates of future, future cash flows if there is significant financing component, what we noted in here is the fact that IFRS literature typically requires discounting estimates of future cash flows when there is significant financing component. So we are recommending that the measurement technique for regulatory assets reflects discounted estimates of future cash flows if there is significant financing component. The third feature in here is to update estimates of future cash flows if changes occur. And for this feature, we consider the analysis of the characteristics of the regulatory assets, the variability of the cash flows, their contribution to cash flows. And we discuss the nature of the regulation, and what it means is that the stream of cash flows expected to result from regulatory assets is typically stable, predictable, but it's not contractually fixed because cash flows will be affected, for example, by demand risk. So they will be exposed to some variability. However, we think that that variability will typically be low. As a result, we recommend that the measurement technique reflects estimates of future cash flows that are updated if needed. And updating those estimates would also mean that any changes in the measurement due to impairment would already be factored in, and consequently, no separate impairment procedures would be required. And last but not least, the fourth feature, to keep discount rate established at initial recognition and change, We support this recommendation on the basis of the users. We think users are not interested in changes in value of regulatory assets due to changes in the discount rate. We think they are more interested in understanding changes in the cash flows because of changes in performance or changes in the regulatory environment. And because of this, then we recommend that the discount rate that is established at initial recognition should not be changed subsequently. In slide 42, we highlight why we think this technique will result in information that is useful. And we think that the measurement will provide information about the amounts, timing, and certainty of the cash flows. And it will also provide information about the variability in performance that is compensated for through the rate adjustment mechanism. As I said before, we also prepared in these slides a set of examples to illustrate the features of this measurement technique. We are not considering going through those examples in detail in this presentation, but we are happy to take any questions you might have. And with that then, the questions to the board are in slide 45, but we think that another way of reordering the slides could have worked better. So we would like the board to go to slide 41, and from there then we will ask the questions to the board, because we think we can formulate the questions in an easier way from that slide. We will have three questions for the board. The first questions will be focused on the first box at the top of the slide, and it would be whether does the board agree that the measurement technique for regulatory assets should reflect A, estimates of future cash flows that the regulatory assets will generate, which will include the components identified in this bullet, and does the board agree that the measurement technique for regulatory assets should also reflect discounted estimates of future cash flows if there is significant financing component? That's the first question for the board.
Let's first discuss that.
I was going to talk about it more generally. Are we allowed to?
Yeah. So
overall, I agree with where you've landed in terms of what your recommendation is for the measurement and the discount rate, etc. And the fact that you take into account discounting if there's a significant financing component. But I guess I get there because of a number of assumptions, which I think probably sort of hold true, but might be just worth pointing them out. So if you look at IFRS 9 as a contrast, and I do that partly because it's used quite a lot as a sort of one of the comparisons, at least, that's made to build the analysis in the paper, you would get to amortized cost measurement, which means that you would have discounting if there was a significant financing component for a trade receivable, and you would not update the discount rate on the basis of a number of different assumptions. And one is that the cash flows are simple enough, and that the entity that holds the asset is actually going to hold the asset and collect those cash flows over time. And because of that business model and because of the simplicity of the cash flows, we conclude that amortized cost is the most relevant information. So I think what we're sort of implicitly assuming here is that, given what we know about regulatory arrangements, it tends to be the case that the cash flows are simple.
Yes.
And it tends to be the case that the rate-regulated entity will perform and collect over time. And so I think we're therefore concluding where we'll always be happy that it would be measured on that way, because that's the assumption that that's the normal environment. But I guess it does mean that if, in theory, you had a situation where the cash flows actually were more complicated because there was more variability in what might cause them to be reassessed over time, or if you had somebody who was able to and confident, and the market was confident enough that they definitely would be able to generate that top-up amount that's underlying the regulatory asset, they might be able to securitize it and therefore collect an upfront amount instead of sitting to wait for payments over time. If you were in a 9 environment, if you had somebody that had trade receivables and they intended to securitize them and sell them, we wouldn't allow them to measure at amortized cost because their business model is not to sit there and collect. And I think we're assuming that that's probably typically not the case. Mm. Is that fair?
This is not the business model of the regulatory entities, regulated entities. They are fairly stable and predictable. They have fairly stable and predictable cash flows, and this is why the measurement technique that we are proposing should accommodate the variability that those cash flows might have, because the variability of these cash flows is deemed also to be low.
But anyway,
so we are in a different environment.
If they were to securitize it, wouldn't they get into a different accounting anyway?
Well, not if we declare that it's going to be amortized cost.
Well, but if this asset turns into a security financial instrument, then you just automatically get into a financial...
But at the time that they originate it, you've still got to work out how you account for it until the securitization occurs. And that's the period of time I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So if you had a trade receivable and you hold them, and then when you collect enough of them, you securitize them, while you're holding them and collecting them, you wouldn't measure them at cost because you're exposed to price risk, and that's what I'm talking about. So your response to me is they've got a very stable business model and blah, 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 but that can be the reason why people do securitization transactions, because that's the perfect sort of cash flow to securitize. So I don't think that's normal, but it is an assumption underlying what we're doing, I think.
I think it's a reasonable point as well. I mean, I think we have seen a small number of examples where people have securitized, so we maybe just need to double-check a little bit more detail of the time period between generating the assets and the time that they securitize them, just to be safe.
And so I'm fine, but I think it's different to what we've done in other places, and I use 9 as my contrast, because there we say, yes, that's fine if it's simple cash flows and if you're going to collect them, whereas here we're sort of saying, because of the environment, we're assuming they're simple cash flows and we're assuming you'll collect them. And it's a subtle difference, but it is a difference, I think. The other thing that struck me as different to what we've done elsewhere, I think both in 9 and 15, which again is probably appropriate because of the environment, but I think it's good to at least acknowledge that we're thinking about it that way, is that when we look at variability of cash flows for 9 and 15, I think in the first instance we think about measuring the variability of the contractual cash flows, and then we think about collectability as a second step. So in IFRS 9, if I've got a 10-year bond with, you know, normal bond cash flows, I don't get different accounting based on whether I've got a high-risk or a low-risk obligor with greater cash flow variability because of credit risk. I just say the contractual amounts are very predictable. Whereas here, I think we're looking collectively at credit risk and the contractual amounts, and not looking at does that therefore get measured at cost and then there's an overlay of an impairment model, but rather we're baking them into one measure.
Yeah.
And I presume that's because we think there's a low risk of collectability.
Yeah.
Or uncollectability.
Uncollectability. And because the regulator has also factored all of those items when approving.
And so I guess the only, for completeness, my only other observation on that would be that I think when we did 15 and 9, we were told that investors were interested to understand what was collectible from a contractual perspective and to think about credit risk as a separate item. And are we confident that that split isn't needed in this case? I think your gut reaction, your reaction to me is probably yes, but I think it's something. And then just to be pedantic, and I said this to you offline, trade receivables under 9 aren't in a special regime. It's all subject to business model and SPPI, so we can't say all trade receivables are measured at amortised cost. But so we just need to be careful with saying that.
Mary?
Two things. And actually, well, started off two things when I put up my card, then some of Sue's comments made it three. So I'll start with reactions on a couple of those. So you were talking about being explicit about the assumptions, and I think we have to be explicit about the assumptions, because if we're saying we're assuming X, we then have to go on and say, and if you don't meet this assumption, then this accounting might not apply, as opposed to, because it applies for most, you get to sneak in as long as you meet the general scope. So I think we have to think about what some of the assumption, what the impact is of you're within the scope overall, but you don't satisfy the assumptions that underlie the selection of model. And we don't have to go down every rabbit hole and every possibility, but for the key ones, I think you're right. That's why we have to be explicit about what the assumptions are. A second second thing about collectability, I think I hadn't thought about it quite that way, but I think that's quite right. And it, the answer for rate regulated may be it depends. And what I mean by it depends is in the notes, I think, on the slides, there's a comment that in many regimes, the rate regulator may compensate the rate regulated entity for credit losses. So in effect, credit losses becomes part of what, you know, gives you a an additional regulatory asset. But if that's not the case, then do we want to separate out the, you know, the accounting for the credit impairment if you as the entity actually bear the credit risk, the collectability risk, for amounts to which you are contractually entitled for, you know, goods and services delivered. And the reason I say it depends is because it may depend on the regulatory regime and whether or not you get some kind of compensation for it. And that kind of leads me to one of my two original points, which is I think we're right to look at this simple fact pattern now, but certainly my recollection of the feedback from the request for information is that very few regulators, or very few entities today are in a pure regulated mode, and most have some degree of hybrid in the scheme, so that for many aspects of the regulation, it's agreed, and then there's a plus and minus band within which they either suffer the losses or get the benefit, whether it's efficiency or demand risk or other things. And I think I don't want to try and discuss it today, but I think we have to bring in that, that feature, not just next month when we do the additionally complex examples that Mariella previewed, you know, the, or the intention to do that, but also we have to stop and say, if this is the dominant design of schemes, you know, that they have some hybrid nature, go back and say, does it or does it not call into question any of the assumptions or conclusions that we've reached? And the other thing, and this is, again, another request for June rather than today, is, you know, we're talking about updating, as you said in your summary of conclusions, updating the cash flows, and that may just be shifts in timing about we thought we could collect it next year, but we're actually going to collect it the following year. Or it may be in amount because you do, for example, have some kind of demand risk, for example. I think what would be helpful is to go back to the conceptual framework and say, here are all the components of a current value measurement. You know, one is cash flows, another is discount rate for time value of money, another is own credit, you know, and just compensation for bearing uncertainty as a separate element, and just have a whole list of them and analyze them versus these to say why we think it is or isn't cost beneficial. I think you have a lot of the thinking in here, but I think we should pull it together, and because I think we've heard that users are interested in the cash flows and they're not, they don't want the entity to value them as much. That would explain why we might not update other things, but I think we should just make sure that we don't have any oops moments in terms of thinking through the characteristics. Now, the last part, if I can, I agree with not going through the examples in detail, but I wanted to highlight and check a distinction that's implicit in the examples, and I think it's really important in terms of understanding what we say are cash flows versus measurement of those cash flows. Sounds a little geeky. If you look at slide 36, this is what you said is the less typical situation in which the entity's compensation includes a margin on operating activities. So in this case, you're saying that the, you know, the asset that you've earned by the activities conducted in the first period includes the margin. And so therefore the margin is included in a year X1. But if what the regulator has promised you, and this is shown in a couple of the examples, is interest for the delayed settlement or a return on assets, we're showing that as earned in the period in which, you know, over the time that you're compensated for or in the period in which you have the assets invested. Now, I'm highlighting this because go back 6 or 9 months, whenever it was, we got kind of into a tangle about what you were projecting forward and discounting back and, you know, when you should be recognizing things. So I think you're taking us back to saying it's not absolute comparability in the sense of it's not rigid comparability, and I think false comparability in terms of everybody must measure all these things in this way. You're saying follow the terms of the agreement and reflect things in the period in which the regulatory agreement says you earn them. And that's not follow the contractual nominal amounts. It's saying if they compensate you for time value of money, earn that, you know, bring that in as a cash flow.
Yes.
Bring that in as a scheduled cash flow in the period in which they credit you. Yeah. If they give you capital, bring that in the period in which, as a cash flow in which they credit you. Our discounting discussion is wholly separate. And we're going to look at that depending upon how long the timing is. And I think it's really important to flag that you're treating those interest and capital amounts as cash flow amounts and not tangling them up in the discounting discussions that we're going to have later. So I think the examples reflect things in the right way, but I really wanted to highlight that it's important that we think about those items as additional cash flows and that we're reflecting them as cash flows in the period in which you earn them, you perform one of the activities that gives you that right, rather than making it all baked into the present value calculation.
I think that's a really good point, and why we've kind of shifted the emphasis from the questions from slide 45 into slide 41, because the first box on slide 41 is really estimating what the cash flows are going to be before we get involved in discount rates or changes in discount rates. So I think that's a really good way of pulling it all together, Mary. Thank you.
Doug.
Thank you. I basically agree with your proposal in the slide 41, but I have slight concern with A2, which is margins. This was pointed out, Mary, as well. So if you look at page 32, in example, so you recognize the margin of 300 in the year X1. So then if you compare this in the difference between example 2 and example 1, in the case of example 1, the amount of profit or loss is exactly equal to the amount of the return of PPE, because the agreement is based on the PPE, so it does not include margin. But if you go to the example 2, the regulatory agreement includes margin on the operating expense. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you included that as a measurement, margin of 30 in the year one. And as a mechanism, I do understand. I think it's correct, as long as there is an agreement. But my concern is, you know, if it's a margin is just 5%, and which is really recoverable within a short period of time, it's not no problem. But what if the margin ratio could be 30% or 40% in the environment of very inflationary economic situation? And in order to incentivize the operator to get into this operation, regulator may provide higher margin. And the margin on the operating expense is somehow very strange, because if the regulatory agreement is to compensate the cost, it shouldn't include the margin, because just simply compensate the cost. It may include some inflationary changes, but the line between the interest and the margin is quite difficult, and sometimes CapEx and OPEX differentiation is always very fine line. So then once we make a standard in this way that you can include the margin and then you can recognize it in the year one, so that's that makes me, you know, not very happy because it could be utilized within the regulatory agreement so that to incentivize the operator to earn earlier. So that is only the concern I have.
Well, I support the staff recommendation, and I would like to make two comments. First of all, I think we should not lose from sight that we are developing this model as a supplement to the accounting under IFRS 15. So to me, credit risk in particular is to be handled through IFRS 15 requirements. And the risk that I think the regulatory asset is subject to is the demand risk. But in itself, I don't see it as being subject to credit risk in itself. It is when it develops and becomes part of a trade receivable, I think, that credit risk kicks in. Because we are looking at what the regulatory agreement brings in on top of IFRS 15, I think it's right to take into account the cash flows in the why they are going to the regulatory agreement indicates. Whatever the components. Whatever the logic that the regulatory, I have problems this month. Incredible, I can't speak. But regardless of the reasoning that the regulator has followed, regardless of how ultimately the cash flows are built, what we want to capture is those cash flows that the entity can expect because of the regulatory agreement. So I'm fully supportive of your recommendations, and I really want to insist on the fact that it's the resulting cash flow that we're looking at, much less than the components.
That's an interesting point, but it is the resulting cash flows, but aren't the resulting cash flows got credit risk attached to them?
But I think Françoise has just raised a point that the staff has to go back and think about for the next one, which is, if I earn a regular entitlement charge two, but I think I only will collect 1.9 because of credit when it becomes a trade receivable, et cetera, do I factor that into my measurement of the regulatory asset so that, or do I just recognize it based on two, which is my right to charge and deal with everything?
And I think that's her assessment.
Yeah. But it's really interesting to think about it.
I think we need to look at that. I think it's a good point.
Yeah.
But to me, it's past the demand risk.
Yeah.
That I call it demand risk because I can't identify the
credit risk.
The debt side, in fact. The debt side is
that doesn't mean it's not credit risk.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's not credit risk just because you don't know what the source of it is.
But we need to look at that.
Yeah, but good point, really. Yeah. Thanks. It's a very good point, interesting point by Françoise. I would like to really commend the staff on the way you introduced the issue for us, starting with slide 47 and focus on the issues that we would like to take from this meeting. I think it's very important for us to have this clarity around. Of course, June expect more complicated a little bit. When it comes to the proposal in slide 41, I do agree with you. I think this is the right approach for these regulatory assets and liabilities. Now I'm calling them assets and liabilities, not rights and obligations anymore, since we decided. Just one comment on I guess at least my experience on the concerns by TAC about the margins. I think we should consider margins. In other IFRSs, we do not take margins separately, and you stress that in slide 32. So I think we should take My experience with these industries is not very, very common for the regulator to provide higher margins to compensate for inflation. This is generally established in the contractual terms, and is generally related to the return on equity or return on investment or whatever. So I don't think we should really take this out. So the way you propose, I think, is the right way. And also, just to adjust a little bit, what we are seeing here is not really the schemes where the regulator compensate for the costs only. We are seeing the more, I would say, modern, contemporary schemes where the regulator can compensate costs and add additional layers. So I do support your proposal.
Sure. Just to build on what Francoise said, because it is a very good point, I think what would be good, interesting for me at least, for the staff to come back on, is to think about what exactly it is in the cash flows that we're trying to measure. Because if it's actually how much am I going to be able to recover through this adjustment mechanism, which is the P times Q question, I think that is pre-credit risk. That's what am I entitled to under the agreement, in which case I think this whole chat about credit risk actually isn't relevant. I think Francoise might be right that it only arises once you've actually got a trade receivable, because at that point in time that's when collectability risk arises, in which case we can set that whole thing aside. But it would be good for you guys to go away and maybe come back and confirm that to us.
Martin? Yeah. I also agree with staff recommendation on the measurement, and my rationale is when I'm coming with for this whole project regarding from the performance statement, because my understanding is that we want to, I would use the word matching, but we want to see, okay, what is kind of the performance statement to enable users, okay, to predict the future cash flows out of these agreements. And therefore, I think matching is here, I think, the key element. And it's not coming from the asset side to measure kinds of assets if they would be securitized or sold or whatever. That is not the core objective of this project. And therefore, I really think, okay, this proposal on measurement, not updating discount rate, have it more on a, I think, cost basis, I think I totally agree, because that will reflect then the performance statement, what we want to achieve, and not then performance statement, which is then by theoretical discount rate movements or whatever, because I think that is not the focus of this project, and therefore I agree with the staff proposal.
Mary?
Coming back on the question that you're asking us about, do you support the proposal for the measurement of cash flows? I do. I think that was implicit in what I said before, but you know, want to say it explicitly. But I also wanted to highlight one other thing, which is that what you are talking. I want to remind us all that the unit of account here that we're talking about is the individual adjustment. So when we say we're updating the future cash flows, we're making a decision that if I earned in year XO an entitlement to, you know, my measurement of it is 3 in 2 years' time, that at the end of X1, I'm looking to say, do I still expect to earn that 3? It's not a what is my total of regulatory assets less the ones I've captured plus the new ones. Yes, I am doing that, but we're talking about updating the cash flows for each individual adjustment as you get maybe more information, especially in a hybrid scheme, about whether I expect to get more than 3 or less than 3, because, you know, for whatever the basis of that measurement is. That, you know, that's, it's the individual item, it's not updating the total. The total will get updated as the sum of the totals of the individual items.
Exactly.
Okay. Can we vote on the staff's recommendation? So that's A and B together, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Full house, yes.
The second question that we have for the board is whether the board agrees to update estimates of future cash flows if changes occur. That would be bullet A of the second box in slide 41.
What if you say no?
Can I just check what that means? So say that I've got an amount which I'm going to be able to recover under the regulatory agreement, a timing difference, and I thought that it was going to be recovered in the next year, but it turns out that it's only going to be recovered in year three instead of year one. The effect of that will flow through to P&L. Yeah, so I'll take the new cash flows and discount them at whatever my rate is, and that will flow through like an amortized cost measurement. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Martin?
And only one question. When we updating these cash flows for whatever kind of reason, is it then reported separately in P&L? Because then users can understand what is only an updated number and what is a kind of... Because I think it is important to differentiate between what is an estimate update of future cash flows and what is really the original thought when we establish this regulatory asset. Because I think if users want to estimate based on this earnings number future cash flows, they have to distinguish between both. But I was not sure if you think about it, of your proposal.
This would be a presentation question?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's something that we have been thinking about, and we'll pick it up in presentation.
Okay. Yeah.
Obviously, materiality will kick in as well, but we will be looking in presentation about any disaggregation of the movements in the amounts from period to period.
Okay, John?
Yeah, I want to confirm that those updated estimation will go to P&L or to make adjustments to the regulated assets and liability already recognized?
Both.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Okay.
Mary?
No. In some cases, not both. Just offset the assets you have already recognized, not go to the P&L.
So that would adjust the carrying amount, and then there'd be an amount in P&L.
Yeah. Which is just like any other change of accounting estimates.
Well, it's not like any other change in accounting estimates, because it depends upon what we're estimating, because I can think of instances in which the change in estimate, when it adjusts an unrecognized amount, you only see coming through in future periods, and sometimes you're recognizing the catch-up in the current period as an adjustment. It was Sue's comment before about...
Because this is a present value of cash flows model, I think that's why I assumed that it would be adjusting the amount, and there'd be an adjustment to the carrying amount and an amount in P&L.
Yeah. This is something that we are also planning to discuss next month, the accounting for those changes of future cash flow.
So the question this month is whether we do it, and then next month we can look at the detail of how
we do. Do we support staff recommendation?
14.
Details to come.
Okay.
And the third question then is whether the board agrees to keep the discount rate established at initial recognition unchanged.
Do we agree?
And next month we will discuss what discount rate and
what. What does that mean?
I wanted to ask a question before we voted, which is, could you just pause for a second and remind us of which part in here is the analysis that supports not updating the discount rate? I'm not throwing a real wobbly. I just want to make sure we know which arguments we are thinking about when we say we have the evidence.
24.
There's slide 24, which also links in, I think it's slide 22, on the information that we've had from users, that they're focusing really on what's the amount and the timing of the cash flows themselves rather than the value of the cash flows compared to a market.
Cost-based measure.
Okay. So therefore we're saying, well, if there is a significant financing component because there's a gap where it would matter, and we'll talk about when that is, then we will recognize interest income for the financing activities, and we'll talk about what rate and what patterns.
Yeah.
But if there, and that's when the discount rate comes into play, having determined that there is a financing element, even if we're updating the cash flows, we're not going to update the discount rate, because what we've heard, and this is what you're saying, is slide 22, is that the users really want info about the amounts,
yes,
not the values of the amounts.
Yes.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're moving to current issues.
Yeah. It just creates noise in the P&L.
If I could just pick up something on what Mary said, is just because so we're in the future, we're going to be both amount and timing of cash flows may affect the carrying value, right? So we decided. And elsewhere, we said discounted estimates of future, if there is a significant financing component. So if we aren't discounting at all because we didn't think there was any, and somehow they push it off into the future, and we're stuck with zero. Like, I just, do you want to think about that circumstance, please?
Yeah.
When you come back?
So effectively, that's almost shifting from a, we didn't think there was a significant finance component, but circumstances have changed, and we now.
And so, yeah, if you just kind of stress test with a couple of these unusual circumstances, just picking up, I think, on
But you're talking about a really a demand risk scenario, so that I thought I would sell enough next year to collect this all, and I'm not going to, so the collection is pushed out, as opposed to the regulator comes in and alters the regulatory agreement to say, I know I told you you could collect it next year, I'm going to change the rate agreement. Because I think we can change the rate agreement out and deal with it generically as changing the rate agreement.
Well, but I don't want to get into it. It could almost, in my mind, have been either. Because sometimes it might simply say, we will not collect it all. Mm-hmm. And which I think they sometimes do. And so they take out the demand risk in the sense, as long as you're not worried about the time value of money. So all I'm just saying is think about whether that would matter.
Yeah. I think when we've got as our plan for June to look at possible changes in the discount rate, and one of them is, does it affect the cash flows, which is Mary's point about a change in the agreement. But yeah, we'll pull in to that same consideration what happens if there's just a shift in timing without a change to the actual agreement.
Françoise? Yeah, my understanding was that if the regulator had the possibility of not complying with the regulation, the regulatory agreement, the regulation would not be in the scope.
Yes, because we need to have that effectively a contractual agreement. The regulator can't just change their mind.
Enforceable.
Normally they cannot.
No, they're bound by the agreement as well.
Okay, so do we still support the staff recommendation?
Yep.
14, okay. I suggest summarize your success. Yeah.
Overall support for the recommendation stated in slide 41 of the slide deck. I would probably then highlight a caveat on it, and it is for the staff to confirm whether the estimates of future cash flows are being built pre or post credit risk. I think that's the main item in here for us to confirm on our recommendation. And there are a few other items that we were aiming and we were planning before also to continue discussing next month anyway. So.
All right.